Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the country's immigration crisis. Just as in 2016, President Trump is making immigration a key part of his reelection campaign. But his Democratic opponent, whoever she or he ends up being, will have to talk about it as well. Thousands of Central American families are coming across our southern border each day seeking asylum. Millions of people are living in the U.S. without authorization. So what should be done? I asked Angela Kelly of Open Society Foundations to talk about the immigration challenges we're facing and solutions she hopes Democratic candidates and leaders will offer. Angela, it's good to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane.
Give me a sense of what's going on right now at our border.
Well, it's chaotic and it's being mismanaged. We have large numbers of families that are coming from Central America, mostly women and children. They are not evading detection. They are looking for the Border Patrol to essentially put themselves forward and to try to apply for political asylum because of the violent conditions in their country. The administration is responding in a number of ways. One, by only allowing a few people to come in at certain ports of entry to even apply. Two, by sending people back to Mexico, where they have to remain there until their immigration case can be heard.
And that takes how long?
Months. It can take years. Exactly right, because where our government resources go is into enforcement and not into adjudications. And so you see this, you know, tremendous backlog of cases. And then other people are, of course, detained. And we're getting, you know, more heartbreaking stories about particularly children who continue to be separated from their parents and who are dying in custody.
How many people were taken into custody last week? Do you know?
I think last month it was 133,000 people came in. So I guess you could divide by four.
Gosh.
So the numbers are growing. I've heard they've dropped off just a little bit, and that might be because of the weather, because it's so hot, it's so dangerous.
And you've got many, many families seeking asylum.
Yes. You know, I've been doing immigration work for decades now, and that's what's really changed, Diane, is that, you know, we have the system built up to detect and apprehend Mexican males coming to work. But what are coming now are females and their children. And that's a very different type of migrant with very different type of needs. But yet what we're doing is applying that kind of enforcement-oriented guys with guns approach towards them. And that is what's causing a lot of the heartbreak, frankly, in terms of how we're seeing particularly children being treated.
So where are they living or being housed as they try to come across?
There are a number of Customs and Border Patrol or CBP facilities. They're actually not all known to advocates, which makes it really difficult to find people. CBP is also moving people in large numbers, sometimes just releasing them into the care of shelters, other times, as I said, sending them back to Mexico. But I met yesterday with a longtime advocate from El Paso who's particularly troubled because, you know, it was overwhelming when large numbers of people were being released to shelters, but at least they were then being clothed and fed and making contact with her family in the U.S. But now they're seeing fewer people released and they don't know where they're going. It is an unfortunate consequence, particularly of this administration, that we just don't have the kind of information that we need about the kinds of facilities, where people are being held, for how long.
And why is it we don't have that information?
They've been refusing to give that information. So you've got congressional inquiries, of course, that are being made, FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests that are being denied, press that are also making inquiries and can't get the information. And so this is happening in a chaotic way under, frankly, the cloak of darkness. And what's at the center of this, again, are women and children. I mean, we can do so much better, Diane.
Of course. And what about children, minors, who are coming across the border without parents?
Yes. So we have unaccompanied minors. They're afforded protections under a court settlement that limits the number of days that they can be held in detention, that ensures that they get just some very basic services. and also through a piece of legislation that's to protect victims of trafficking. These are both efforts that the Trump administration is trying to undo and overturn.
How so?
By issuing a rule through an administrative process that would undo the protections of the court settlement. And then legislatively, of course, they would have to pass legislation, and that's going to be harder for them to do.
But then what happens to those kids as they come across? Are they just told to go back? Or
Some are sent back. Some are reunited with family that they have here. The vast majority of unaccompanied children have family members already in the U.S. Often it's parents, but certainly it's aunts, and it's uncles, and it's cousins. Again, these are countries that have been sending migrants to the U.S. for decades. The administration has, though, in the last few years, been going after the families that receive the unaccompanied minors.
So they're afraid to go get them.
That is why, exactly, Diane. So we have a record number of children that are being held in detention. Many of them have an aunt in Pittsburgh. They have an uncle in Seattle. But they can't risk their own family's safety by coming and getting their nephew in El Paso. It is heartbreaking, and it's very, very common, and it's unprecedented.
So explain the system to us. If people come across and they want asylum, what's the system in place to determine whether they deserve asylum?
Right. They have to meet a really, really difficult burden of proof. You have to show that you have a credible fear of being persecuted. It has to be a well-founded fear. And it has to be on account of one of five grounds. So it can be your political opinion, it could be your race, your religion, your membership in a social group like that. So it's very specific. This administration, and of course this has been a standard that has been around for decades. The former Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, what he did was he, by issuing a decision on his own, overturning years of precedent, is limited who can apply for asylum. So women who are once victims of domestic violence, who can't get relief from the police because they don't view that as a crime to beat your wife, or people who are being recruited for gangs. Again, women and children are the most targeted. Used to be the basis for asylum, membership in a social group. You have a fear of persecution. And Sessions wiped that away and declared that no longer a basis for being able to get asylum. And by doing that, has effectively rendered people ineligible from any protection.
Any protection. So if they are among the few that have applied for asylum, how long do they have to wait to find out whether it's granted?
They may wait years. The backlog of cases, I think, is about 600,000 cases in the immigration courts right now.
And where are these people as they wait?
So when they come to the U.S. and they're apprehended, you know, they're immediately put into the system. And they have to have an interview with an asylum officer and make a credible case, show that they're fleeing, that there's a reason that why they're fleeing. And if they have a credible case, and the vast majority do, then they are released. But of course, we know who they are, many of them with ankle monitors, many of them have to pay bonds. And if they're lucky, there is a shelter or a respite center that is a community-based organization that will give them a shower and clothing and help them make contact with their families. So let's say that they move to their family member in New Jersey. Their case follows them. It's not as if they're now like scot-free. Of course,
right.
They have to, in many cases, report on a regular basis to ICE. Again, ankle monitors are used. Bonds are in place. And eventually they will come in and they have to show the well-founded fear of persecution standard of proof I described.
When you talk about how an immigrant might prove that there is gang violence back home, that seems to me pretty difficult.
It's very difficult to prove it if you are unrepresented. I was an asylum attorney many years ago, and I can tell you that I would win my cases. It's not just because I'm a great lawyer, I think I was, but it's because when you're represented by able counsel, they are able to put together the kind of documentation that, yes, these gangs exist in this part of Guatemala. Yes, these gangs exist in other parts. There's no place that you can flee for safety. That, yes, you are are the kind of person that they go after. They can get the affidavits from the family members. And the percentage of people who win, if they have counsel, is very, very high. I don't know, it's like over 50%. But if you don't have counsel, then it's like less than 10%. Of course, it depends on the country and so forth. But it is that kind of a difference in outcomes.
And are these all volunteer counsel that are there at the border to assist?
Well, we have seen a sharp increase in the interest of the legal profession to help. And that is certainly one point of contact where you can help at the border. But of course, most people don't stay at the border because, as I described, they have family members that are within the U.S. So what you want to ensure is that if you help that person get released from detention, put up the bond, that that case is then transferred to the attorney that's in New Jersey or wherever the person is. And that's difficult, right? Because you're passing off a legal responsibility. So it's not easy. Yes, we're seeing an increase in attorneys being willing to help, but the need is so much greater.
The Senate Appropriations Committee voted this week to approve $4.6 billion with a B in emergency spending there at the U.S.-Mexico border. The question is, what would it be used for?
Well, I can tell you what we would advocate it be used for. The Office of Refugee Resettlement is the part of the government that takes care of the children. They are, of course, in need of resources. The description that I gave you of what happens at the border, where you have children that are spending, now we're finding out, weeks sometimes in Border Patrol offices, right? Sleeping on floors, not getting adequate food, babies that don't have diapers, kids.
There was one report of such a huge crowd of these young people standing because there was no room to sit.
That's right. And this is an inspector general report. So we're not, it is without a doubt that we have a humanitarian crisis, and the dollars that we need to spend are ones that are commensurate with that kind of a crisis. So Red Cross needs to be engaged, more community organizations, faith groups need to be engaged. You have business leaders that want to step up and donate services and time. And rather than ensure coordination among those, potential sources of support, the government doesn't give information. They don't tell us where people are going. So the dollars that I think should be spent would be to provide these women and children wraparound services. And of course, we have to understand where they are going and make sure that they show up to court. But there's enough evidence that we've had from pilot programs where you've got community-based organizations taking responsibility for these women and kids, and they show up to court. They follow through with the process. And that's really what would, I think, really live up to our ideals as a nation.
I gather that some House Democrats are saying they want assurance that these monies are going to be spent for these people coming across rather than have the money used to build a wall.
That's exactly right. And sometimes we worry about the shell game that this administration plays with the dollars. So rather than providing it for protection, it's for more enforcement. You see this, for example, Trump was tweeting, which is how we learn about policy these days, that there will be raids soon. And we're getting reports that there are going to be raids of, this is in the interior of the United States, where ICE is going to be knocking on people's doors in pre-dawn hours and looking for families that they say have received a final order of deportation. Now, if they come across someone else, they'll pick that person up too. So this is how our government resources are now being used.
A quick break. When we come back, more from Angela Kelly. Here is the rest of my conversation with Angela Kelly. She's Senior Strategic Advisor at Open Society Foundations. Tell me about the status of the wall in terms of President Trump's supporters.
I think the cries for a wall are not as much about the wall itself, but they are about, and this is completely reasonable for a Trump supporter or a Clinton supporter or whoever you're supporting in 2020, which is to understand that we need sensible solutions.
Of course.
Of course, there is a security issue here, but there's also a humanitarian issue.
And what concerns me is that among this throng, if I may call it that, of Democratic candidates, I've not yet heard a great deal of conversation or talking points about immigration. Where are the Democrats on this?
There has been some discussion of it, but I think you're right. It's not their go-to first issue to talk about, but there will certainly be lots of opportunities where they'll have to be responding to events or to Trump policy. So I don't think that they're going to be able to avoid the issue. Some candidates have very detailed plans. Julian Castro, Beto O'Rourke, Kamala Harris are three that come to mind. And then there are some, because they're senators like a Senator Warren or Cory Booker, they've been in a position where they've spoken on this issue in the past. So I'm not fearing that they're not going to come forward. What I want them to do, though, is to come forward with solutions and not just slam Trump.
Do we have any idea how many people are currently living in the U.S. without authorization?
Well, it's fewer now because of the rate of deportations, but it's been about 11 million. And again, the numbers are dropping, so it's probably more like 10.8 million. Of that, some are people who are part of different programs. So you've got Dreamers, for example, undocumented youth, that there's about 750,000 of them that have received work authorization through that program called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that Obama created now 7 years ago. So they're undocumented in the sense that they don't have permanent residency in this country, but they are certainly known to the government.
And are they liable for deportation?
Yes. I mean, they are vulnerable to deportation. The program that currently gives them protection is one that the Trump administration has been trying to stop and to cancel, essentially, and render them deportable. That was challenged in the courts, and there's an injunction in place now so that young people who have this DACA protection may maintain it.
But for now.
For now. But it's, you know, like all litigation, it hangs by a thread, and then it finds itself in front of the Supreme Court, where we've got a, you know, different makeup on the court.
You know, it strikes me as I hear all of this, Angie, that people still want to come. Despite the hurdles they know they'll face, they still want to come.
I think that there is just there's a chemistry in this country that's very special, and it attracts a certain kind of person who is willing to take risks and just sees a better future. I mean, that's certainly my family's immigrant story. Both of my parents are immigrants from South America. And my grandmother was very courageous and put her daughters on a plane and sent them from Bolivia. And, you know, now all of us of the next generation are college graduates. Of course, you know, we've married, we have children. I mean, so that is the success story of this country. And, you know, I don't want to be Pollyannish about it. I understand that we need to have a sensible system that's got limits and that really scrutinizes, all right, you know, what kind of workers do we need? What kind of family relationships? But we're not having that conversation, Diane. What we're having is a build the wall, or they're all fraudulent asylum seekers. You know, it's very polarized.
Or, as the president has said more recently, we want to let in those people who have certain skills or higher levels of education.
If those were the standards, then I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you, because my mom would not have passed Donald Trump's muster. It is reasonable, though, for us to say that we want to have people who have needed skills, and the notion of a merit-based immigration system sounds so sensible. But again, if what's behind it is that you have to speak English, that you have to have a PhD, that you have to show that you've got, you know, $100,000 in your bank account, then it's only going to bring in a handful of people. And that's just not enough to keep this country's economy humming.
And apparently that is the way in which the president would like to change the entire immigration
policy. Yes, it's very narrow
policy.
And it's very white.
So on this policy of separating children from their parents, have the Democrats offered any specific ideas.
Yes. There has been legislation that's been introduced in the House and Senate that I think is very sensible, because not only does it look at asylum reform and ways that we can better manage the flow here, but there's also proposals that we start doing identification of refugees outside the United States, and that we engage partners like Canada, like Costa Rica, like Mexico, like Belize, like Panama, and that we strengthen, in some of those countries' cases, their own asylum systems, so that, yes, we can take our fair share of refugees, but that it is a regional responsibility. The U.S. doesn't have to go at it alone. And other proposals examine what would it take for folks to stay in their countries? Most people want to stay home. Most people do not want to take that very dangerous journey. Well, they will be robbed and they will
but
be raped.
But that would involve monies toward those countries.
Exactly. It would involve investments that show that they're able to make progress in judicial reforms, in violence protection programs, in education programs. I mean, this is hard work, but that's what leadership looks like. And that's what I think the next administration, if there's a different person sitting in the White House, that's the first thing I would urge them to do.
So Julian Castro's program of providing more aid to a country in Central America, what would that involve?
I think, you know, most people are talking about the need to shore up the asylum system in Mexico to ensure, as I said, that the other nations are also in a position to receive refugees, to identify what programs work with community-based organizations in those countries. Right. So that's where the aid goes, and that we have proof points that it is affecting migration patterns. So, you know, on the one hand, we have the government that's giving less and fewer dollars. And on the other hand, we have part of the government complaining about people leaving their home countries. And they don't talk to one another. So to me, it would be very logical that we would begin to identify what are the programs that have been successful on the ground in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras in ensuring that there's integrity in their judicial system and ensuring that women and kids are safe, and that our aid is tied to those programs' success, and that we see a reduction in the number of people coming to the U.S.
Can we honestly, sincerely do that?
I don't think we have a choice. People aren't coming in numbers because it hasn't gotten too hot yet. I mean, they're going to keep coming. We saw an uptick in numbers under the Obama administration. So it's not just because, I mean, it's made worse by the chaos of this particular administration. But we're also seeing, for example, an uptick in people coming from regions of Guatemala who are indigenous. They don't speak Spanish. And so it makes it very difficult to provide translation for them. Huh. Why are they coming? They're coming because the crops that they've grown for generations and generations don't grow anymore.
Oh, I see.
Because of climate change. So we don't have a choice, as not only as the United States, but as with our neighbors to the north and south, to begin to tackle these problems so that those farmers are able to grow something else, right? Or learn to do something else.
So do you believe through the debates that will be forthcoming that we will hear from Democrats detailed programs of what they believe would actually work? Do you think that they will come forth with those ideas so that people can understand that there really are some viable solutions?
Yes, I believe if they want to sit in the White House and
they're
be inaugurated in January of 2021, there will have to be solutions being offered. So what do we do about the pressures at the southern border and the root causes as to why people are coming?
You know, Angie, several years ago, there was bipartisan support on this issue. What happened to that?
Yeah, and it wasn't as long ago as you might think. So in 2013, the Senate passed a bipartisan bill, an immigration bill by a supermajority, and it would have tackled the challenges regarding enforcement. It would have dealt with the 11 million who were in the U.S., and it reached a very creative solution for how to assess the numbers of legal immigrants that we need to come here to work. It was an agreement that was reached by the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO. So when you have business and labor that are willing to get to a handshake and say yes, and when you have the Senate able to pass a piece of legislation, again, with a super bipartisan majority, we know there are solutions. We know there are solutions. And what happens is that this issue becomes the political football that gets tossed back and forth. And in the House of Representatives, there was no action on immigration. None. And that bill died. We haven't had a sensible conversation in the Senate or in the House since then.
Angie, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you.
That's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urev-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.